Matthew chapter 17, beginning with verse 22. And as they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he, that is Peter, came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you shall find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." So what we have in our text this morning is a section which is repeated not only in the other Gospels, particularly Mark and Luke, but what we also have is a section that is repeated in Matthew itself. This is the second of 3 prophecies that Jesus makes to his disciples of his going to Jerusalem to be betrayed and killed and handed over, but he will be raised from the dead. So there's a part of this text that's repeated not only in Matthew, but also in the other Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, Mark and Luke. But there's also a portion of this text that's not found anywhere else in the Bible and is very unusual. It is the account of the 2 drachma tax. It is the account of the finding of the coin in the mouth of the fish. And so when we come to a text like this, one of the questions that I've tried to raise over and over again is, why is it that gospel writers include what they include in the stories as they tell it? And we've had an excellent Sunday school series over the past several weeks talking about how we got our New Testament, how the New Testament particularly, and not just the New Testament, but the whole Bible, but particularly the New Testament, how it was put together. And we've touched a little bit on the fact that Matthew, Mark, and Luke weren't written at the exact same time. They are separate witnesses to who Jesus is. They're separate stories in one sense that have a ton of overlap. They have a ton of agreement, but there's also some unique things in them. And one of the questions that we continue to ask is, why is it Matthew includes some things? Why is it he tells the story in the way that he does, different from Mark and Luke? And you'll remember Matthew, Mark, and Luke are known as the Synoptic Gospels. They tell the same story in a very similar perspective. John is like off the charts, just different, same gospel, same Jesus, but tells the story in a very different way. And one of the ways that you can preach through the Gospels is just by harmonizing, like every passage you come to, taking everything else everybody else says, putting it together and preaching kind of a harmony of the Gospels. But we've been trying to focus on, what does Matthew contribute to the gospel? What does Matthew contribute? What particular angle is he coming at? And the name of the overarching series is The Gospel of the Kingdom. And that's one of the contributions that Matthew makes. And so when we come to a passage like this morning, not here verse 22-23, but the next section, one of the questions is, why is it Matthew includes this 2 drachma tax question? Why is it he includes this conversation with Peter? Why is it he includes this? Is it because he's the only one that knew about it? Maybe Luke and Mark, who have different pieces of information of the gospel story. Maybe Matthew, because he was an eyewitness, he was there. Maybe because he was a tax collector, he took particular attention to the fact that this was had something to do with taxes. Maybe he's the only one that had information about it. Maybe he's contributing something to the story. It's a difficult question to answer. That is, why does Matthew include it and Mark and Luke? And I'm going to try to give somewhat of an answer to that as we go along. And so this is an unusual story. Again, it's not found elsewhere in the Gospels. There's no other miracle even of this type. It's not a healing miracle. It's not a raising from the dead miracle. It's not raising the blind. It's not feeding people. It is, for goodness sake, fishing out a fish and the first one you find, finding a coin in its mouth. That's just off the charts, if I can say it reverently, weird compared to all of the others in the Gospels. And so we're going to try to ask a question of why is it so unusual in this way? Well, we'll look at that later. So let's look at verse 22 through 23. First of all, Jesus' second prediction. As they, that is the disciples, were gathered again into Galilee, and you'll remember that they are kind of over their Galilean ministry. They're still in the area, but he's not publicly preaching and teaching and healing in the way that he was previously for those years. But as they're gathering again into Galilee, which is really Peter's home area, it's a couple of the apostles' home base, and it's become Jesus's home base. As they gather there together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." Now, this is the second of the iterations in Matthew where Jesus tells them almost this exact same thing. But you'll see there, italicized is the unique piece of information that he adds here. He's already told them he's going to go to Jerusalem and die and be raised from the dead, to which Peter says, "This is never going to happen. Get behind me, Satan." Here's the second iteration. But the interesting piece he puts in is that the Son of Man is about to be delivered to or handed over into the hands of men, meaning human beings. And we know from the story that will unfold, he is going to be betrayed. And some of your Bibles may actually translate it here, be betrayed. Betrayed isn't quite the accurate word for the Greek word. It is to take something in hand and to hand it over, to pass it over. But I think rightly, we're to understand this does mean something of either the handing over by God the Father of Jesus into their hands. So this is ordained by God. God is handing them over. Or I think probably here, leaning a little bit more into the betrayal of saying that he is actually going to be handed over by, eventually we'll know, one of their own number. So this is a new piece of information. But even with the new piece of information, notice in the passage what they totally miss again. This is the second time that they hear something clearly and yet miss the main point. The main point isn't even the betrayal. The main point is I'm going to be raised from the dead on the third day. And instead of going, well, okay, but yay, they just are greatly distressed. Again, they are missing it. Again, these apostles who are right up against Jesus, who understand and have heard John say, "Behold the Lamb of God who comes to take away the sin of the world." Jesus who has said, "I'm going to Jerusalem to be crucified," or he hasn't given that peace yet, but "I'm going to be killed." They still are missing the fact that the perfect teacher, Jesus himself, tells them, "I'm going there and I'm going to be raised on the third day." They've already heard the teaching of even as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so the Son of Man will be 3 days, three nights in the earth. They should have been putting it together at this point, and they are totally missing it. They are greatly distressed. They are dismayed at the anticipation of Jesus' death, but the resurrection every time completely goes over their head. Here's my application. Lack of understanding of clear teaching is not necessarily ignorance of the teaching or even rebellion against it. They just didn't get it. It wasn't that the teacher was failing in his teaching and clarity. And I also don't think for them it was like, "We're not believing anything you say." No, they are his disciples. Here there is incredible misunderstanding and ignorance, not because of lack of teaching, not because of rebellion, but there is a spiritual blindness, which is not a moral blindness. They are not going to understand this until the Spirit comes and gives them understanding on the day of Pentecost. I don't even think after the resurrection they get it. They're like, after the resurrection, Jesus is raised from the dead. And they're like, "Really? Well, let's go check that out." They're not even anticipating it. They're fearful. They're afraid. But because of their spiritual blindness and because of their lack of experience, and the spiritual blindness is not because of the hardness of heart that they have, it's because the Spirit has not yet fully illumined them to it. And so here's my takeaway, which is be patient with one another and be patient with the church And be patient with disciples of Jesus who sometimes miss some obvious things, but because of some spiritual blind spots or because of lack of life experience, they just don't get it yet. And it's okay. I mean, if Jesus' disciples sitting at the feet of Jesus didn't understand something like the resurrection, which is like the main point, then it's probably okay that we miss some things sometimes and we can be patient with one another as he was with them. That's my application from that point. So that's the new, that's what's repeated in Mark and Luke. That's repeated in the Matthew itself, which let's move then swiftly on to verse 24, this unusual, unique account in all of the Bible. In verse 24, we're told when they come to Capernaum, which is now their hometown, particularly if Peter seems to be Jesus' home base, they've come home. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" And he said, "Yes." And again, the question is, I'm going to raise, is why does Matthew include this? How does it fill in with his story? What does it mean within the context and flow of his narrative? Now, a couple of things I want to point out here. First of all, when it talks about these tax collectors, we're not talking about the kind of tax collector that Matthew had been, who had been despised by everybody. The tax collector, those guys were working for the Roman government. They were working for the oppressors. They were the ones who were gathering the tax and taxation for the Roman roads and to fund the army and to do all the things that Rome was doing. They were the oppressors. They were the government who had bondage and control over them. That's what Matthew had been. These 2 drachma tax collectors have a very specific job, but they're not working for Rome. They're working for the Jews. They are those who are actually welcomed within these towns. I mean, nobody likes to pay taxes, but if you're going to pay taxes for something, this kind of tax was the tax as a faithful Jew you wouldn't mind paying for. These are the ones who have come to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax. Now, what is the 2 drachma tax? Well, the 2 drachma tax was the tax that had been levied against the Jewish people, particularly men 20 years and older, whether you were young whether you were poor or whether you were rich, everybody paid the 2 drachma tax. These were representatives from Jerusalem on behalf of the temple. This was a temple tax. And what did this go for? Well, we can see the origin of this tax back in Exodus 30. If you'll turn there with me quickly, this is important. So if you can turn there, I'll try to wait for you. In Exodus chapter 30, verses 12 through 16, we see what is really the origin of this tax, which is going to explain so much about what I think is going on here. In Exodus chapter 30, verse 11, in the law of Moses, the law of God given through Moses, verse 11, the Lord said to Moses, "When you take the census, the counting of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life, his nephesh, his soul. He will give a ransom for his soul to the Lord." But this ransom for the soul is going to be different than the sacrifices of animals. Notice what it says. "When you number them, that there be no plague among them, when you number them, each one who is numbered in the census shall give this, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary." That is the standard of the sanctuary, which at this time is the tent of meeting. This is the place where the sacrifices are. Aaron and the priesthood rule. So this is to be given this. The shekel is 20 gerahs, in case you were saying to yourself, "Well, how much is that in gerahs?" Well, he tells us. Half a shekel is an offering to the Lord. Verse 14, "Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward shall give the Lord's offering." Remember, this is a ransom for the soul. "The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less." That's pretty unusual, because most of the sacrifice had provisions for different classes of people, the rich and the poor. This one doesn't. It's the same no matter what it is. The cost of your soul is the same whether you are rich or poor. There should have been a little gasp of air. It should have been, "Oh, wait, what was that?" Okay, hold on to that. "The rich shall not give more, the poor shall not give less than the half shekel when you give the Lord's offering to make atonement for your souls." Verse 16, you shall take the atonement money from the people of Israel and give it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may bring the people of Israel to remembrance before the Lord so as to make atonement for your lives, your souls. Three times. This is a ransom shekel to be given for the service of the temple, that or the tabernacle. So that is, to, you know, when stuff wears out, you got to buy new stuff. When things break, you got to get them fixed. This was for the attendance of the priests and the tabernacle. And in the way that the tabernacle, the special dwelling place of God, was going to be built and maintained was through the ransom of their souls, through this shekel, through this offering. So that's what we have back in Exodus chapter 30. And if you start doing the translation of the money, you realize that the 2 drachma tax is actually more than that. Well, what happened? We call it inflation. And so what happens is that after the exile, when they rebuild the temple, you can see different stages in Jewish history where this tax actually went up. It wasn't always going to be this exact amount. It actually goes up. And then you have to factor in the fact of the drachma, which is the Roman money of the time, and so on. But what you have is, just over time, you have, what did I just call it? What did I just say? Inflation. Thank you. Thank you. My mind's already gone to the next one. Okay, so that's what's going on here, is that these men, collectors, plural, have come from Jerusalem out into the cities where the Jews are, and they're walking around and they're going to households and they're going probably door to door in the marketplace and they're keeping listings of, okay, you're Peter Ben Hu, and you're doing what? And have you paid the 2 drachma tax? And this is what it is. Okay, so you're covered. And oh, how about you? We get to you. Yes, who are you? Okay, already paid that. So these men are going around, and this happens before Passover, where they go out, they start out in the cities, and then they come back to Jerusalem. They collect the tax there. And that happens about a month before Passover that they're out collecting these funds. So what we have is these tax collectors coming to Peter. And from what we know of Peter, he would have been a man well known in his community. He has an established business owner. He has a successful fishing business. He was one of the men that would have been well known in the community. And apparently, as best as I can put it together, Jesus and Peter and the apostles have been out. We've been seeing that over the past several months. They've been out. They've been going out to the Gentiles. They've been doing these things in the wilderness. They've been making bread for the people. Or Jesus has been. Now they've come back home, and the tax collectors are like, okay, we're glad you showed up because we have our lists, and Peter and Jesus and you guys, you haven't paid your 2 drachma tax for the temple. Okay, so I think that's the scenario of what's going on as Matthew paints the picture here for us. So they come and they ask an interesting question, and the question, as I picture it in my mind, is why did they ask Peter? That's one question I have. Why is it they ask Peter? And why is it they ask not only Peter why the tax hasn't been paid, but why is it they ask Peter why if Jesus pays the tax or not? So it's a couple of interesting questions. So here's the scenario I'm imagining, is that Peter's the well-known established guy in the community. They know that he is a follower and disciple of Jesus. They knew that disciples did what their masters, their teachers taught. So they come to Peter as a representative for the apostles and for Jesus himself, and they say, hey, Peter. And remember, Peter's grown up here. These are probably the same tax collectors that have come to Peter for however many years since he was 20 years old. So they probably know him as a local guy. So they come to Peter and they say, we got a question for you. And the tone of voice that you imagine this, I think, changes the scenario. Here's how I think they asked it. Does your teacher not pay the tax? And they would have known, maybe Jesus had been, of course, raised in another area. This had become his hometown. But the question is he now teaching as a teacher to disciples? Isn't he paying this? And why might this be? Why this might this be even a question? They're inquiring this because I think it indicates delinquency. If he had paid it, they wouldn't have this question. He's not yet paid it. The deadline seems to be there, and he hasn't paid it. So why are they asking the question? Where they've probably been hearing rumors about Jesus doing some things that are very unorthodox. Things about breaking the Sabbath. Things about not washing hands. And so now they're trying to figure out, okay, is this just something your teacher has exempted himself from, like washing hands and keeping the Sabbath in the way that we've traditionally held it? So I think they're coming in and asking a genuine question. Is it the case that he doesn't pay tax or not? And to which Peter responds, yes. It is such a simple response. It's almost like, yes, let me go get him and we'll take care of it right now. That's the only explanation I have of what's going on here. And so Peter says yes. How would Peter know yes? Because Jesus hasn't taught against it. He's probably been Jesus hasn't taught against it. He's probably seen Jesus in the 2 or 3 years previous at this point of the ministry pay the tax. It's not a big deal. He's not taught against it. And so he's like, yes, it's just a matter of fact that he hasn't paid it yet. So that's some of it. So it's kind of a soft scenario rather than a confrontational scenario. And here's why I think that's important. It's because how he responds to them is totally different than how he responds to the Pharisees. These are two guys just doing their job for the temple tax, asking a genuine question like, in light of the fact that we haven't been paid yet for this, does your teacher not pay that tax? And Peter's like, yes, I'll be right back. Okay? Because his response to them and what he says he doesn't want to do is a hugely different scenario than the hard confrontations that we've seen previously in the book of Matthew and how he's dealing with different people with questions very differently. Okay? So that's where we are. Let's move on to verse 25, 26. So when he came into the house, and there's a question here, is this Peter's house? Is this Jesus's house? Probably, I think it's Peter's house. When he came into the house, Peter and Jesus is there. Jesus spoke to him first. And so here's some questions. How did Jesus know that this was the topic of conversation with Peter and those he's just been talking to? Some commentators say, well, they were outside the house. Probably what happened is the tax collectors came up, knocked on the door. Peter stepped outside the house and said, yes, can I help you? He says, okay, Peter, we got a question for you. Is he not going to pay the tax? And then Jesus is listening out the window. And then when he comes in, he says, hey, I don't think that's what happened. There's a question of exactly how does he know this? I do think that Matthew is, or some people just say, well, he already knew the topic of conversation, he just preemptively. But the way that Matthew frames it seems to be unusual. When Peter comes into the house, Jesus says to him first, in other words, Matthew is saying, this is a big deal. We're going to come back to this later. But he speaks to him first. I don't think he overheard it. I think he has preemptive knowledge of what's about ready to happen and what has already happened. So he comes and he says to him first, spoke to him first, saying, and what's really interesting here is that Peter or Jesus doesn't say, here's the coin, or here's where to go get the coin. Peter walks into the room and Jesus asks a question. And it's a question that seems so off topic for a second. I mean, it has something to do with finances and taxes and such, but it's such a different scenario, and what he's going to say is so off the chart, unusual. It's just like Peter just wants to know if he's, you know, give me the 2 shekel. What do you need? But here's what Jesus asks. What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax, from their sons or from others? So here he changes the scenario. He doesn't ask a question about temple tax. He doesn't ask a question about Jewish tax. He now opens the umbrella of the question and says, let me ask you something. When it comes to tolls or taxes, and it comes to the kings of the earth who exact those taxes from the people, who is it that pays those taxes? Is it the sons of the king, or is it just the citizens of the king? So he asks this almost completely off-topic question to answer and respond because he's going to teach something much larger that's going on here. And so Peter hears this question and here's how it works. Why didn't the king's sons pay taxes in this day? Well, it's very undemocratic of them, but I guess they hadn't heard about democracy in the way that we think of it now. I mean, you expect President Trump's kids to pay taxes, right? They don't get exempt. Well, it didn't work that way back then. Here's how it worked. a king, when he exacted taxes from the people, whether they were his people or the conquered people, those funds went to fund him and his household. So the reason they were exempt is because they're making money, they're exacting money for the king and the royal family and the rule, so the sons don't pay taxes because they're part of the royal family. Their sonship exempts them from taxation. Their sonship exempts them from being taxed and tolled because it is the taxes and tolls that are actually putting breakfast on their table and putting clothes on their backs. That's how the king makes his money. He's not independently wealthy. He doesn't have, King Ahasuerus Tower like Trump does, making his own money, his own businesses. They are making their money in finances by trade and other things, but it is by the taxation of the people. Like it or not, that's how it worked. But that's interesting that Jesus switches the question into that. Okay? That's some of what's going on here. So he asks the question, from whom do you think, Simon, from whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? And Peter and every Jewish boy and girl and every Roman boy and girl would know the answer to this question. Peter says, from others. You're not going to tax the king's kids, the king's sons. They're not going to pay those tolls. Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. And here's where we get a clue into Jesus is taking this temple tax and he's extracting out of it a larger lesson, a gospel lesson that should blow our minds. Those who don't pay taxes, in the analogy of the ancient world, who are not obligated to pay taxes to the king and his court are sons who are free from such taxation. Now, if we didn't have the next verse, we might walk away from this and go, what in the world is he even talking about? What does this mean? How do we apply this? Why does he ask? He's not asking about kings. He's asking about temple taxes. Well, here's what happens then. In verse 27, let me make sure I didn't miss anything here. I didn't. Okay, verse 27. However, in conclusion that he makes, the sons are free from what? From paying taxes to the king because it's their household. However, not to give offense to them, in conclusion of this parable, I haven't even explained. I think it's hilarious. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. When you open his mouth, he will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. And the question is, what in the world is going on here? So here's where some of the commentators ask questions about, okay, is there a similarity between this and what happens when Jesus gets asked the question, do you pay taxes to Caesar? And he asks for the coin, says whose image is on it, and so on. In that scenario, there's a question being asked by the community and being taught by Jesus, which is, do we need to pay taxes to the government? That's not what's being done here. This is a whole different topic. So this is for the temple again. This is to the Jews. This is a ransom for the soul. This is a temple taxation. Jesus says by his little parable something unique. Because the question is, does not your teacher pay the temple tax? And Jesus' response is essentially this is, I'm not a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. I am the son of the Father. The Father doesn't exact tolls from me because I'm in the household. He is here claiming unique sonship that nobody else has except for him. He here takes the kingdom of man and overlays it with the kingdom of God and says, in answer to the question whether I pay the tax, I'm exempt from the toll tax because my soul does not need to be atoned for. Because I am the Son of God and I am without sin. This is deep Christology. This is deep, and I don't think they got it at this point at all. We can look at it 2,000 years and go, oh man, this is deep Christology. But he is saying, I'm a son of the Father. I don't owe the temple tax. I don't need to pay it. I'm not obligated to pay it. As a faithful Jew, I don't need to give that payment because my soul does not need to be ransomed. Now remember that. So he's saying I'm exempt. But here's what he says. However, in the fact that I don't owe this tax, he could legitimately, if the tax collectors had come with Peter to the house, he could stick his head out the window and say, the answer is no. No, I don't need to. I'm uniquely the Son of God, and no. But he doesn't do that. He says, in light of the fact that I don't have to, and I'm not obligated to, I have another concern that's going to help me make a decision in this matter. And that is these two men who have shown up to take this collection of taxes. Because here's what they're going to think. They're going to think, if I respond simply no and don't explain it to them, they're going to think that I'm teaching against the law. They're going to think that I'm teaching that you don't need a ransom for your soul. They're not my followers. They're not my disciples. They don't understand the Christology underneath why I don't need to pay the tax. So here's what's going to happen is they're going to think that they don't need to themselves pay the temple tax or that I'm teaching against it. They're going to think they don't need a ransom for their souls. And that would be a very, very bad judgment on what I'm saying. So here's what I'm going to do. So as not to give offense to them, it could be simply so they don't have to go back and explain to the superiors, like, but Jesus isn't paying the tax. Jesus of Nazareth is not paying the tax. Well, why not? Why didn't you get it from him? I mean, goodness, he's raising people from the dead and he's walking on water. And you expect me to get this coin from him? Could be that. But I think there's something deeper going on. Is they're so not going to understand at this point. I don't want them to be offended and not understand the condition of their souls and their need for their temple and their need for these things. And they don't understand my unique sonship yet and the freedom and liberty that I have as the unique Son of God. Therefore, I want you to go ahead and pay the tax, Peter. Because there's just not enough time and effort and they're not followers and they've got a job to do and they've got to get to the next house. Until they can understand more deeply the secrets of the kingdom, I don't want them to be offended. So I'm going to go ahead and pay what I don't owe for myself. As we'll see in just a moment for Peter. That's profound, man. I'm telling you, it's profound. But here, I think there's also something unique going on. So how is he going to pay this tax that he doesn't owe? Well, is he going to go dip into the bag of the people who had paid them money? So is he going to rob Peter to pay Paul, so to speak? Is he going to take from the generous offerings of the people to pay the tax? Is he going to say, hey, Peter, can you, you know, I don't have a lot of money myself. It's all in the money bag and Judas is skimming off the top of that. Would you mind paying that out of your business? Jesus does something totally amazing. To make provision for the ransom of soul, I'm going to perform a miracle. Something unique and something that you've never seen before. And so this is where the unique and really interesting. Peter, the fisherman, this is the only context in the Gospels or anywhere in the New Testament where this particular form of fishing, which is our common form of fishing, which is fishing by line and hook. All the other times it's nets. He says, no, it's not even going to be that. It's going to be, I mean, you can catch a net and look, you know, and maybe out of 100 fish, you'll find one with a coin. They actually have found coins in the mouths of these fish. Fish like shiny things, and you drop one out of your pocket, and they come looking for them. So it's that in and of itself is not a miracle. Fish swallow coins, apparently, and they've got records of them doing that here at the Sea of Galilee. So that's not the miracle itself, is that fish happen to swallow things that are shiny sometimes. That's why you use the lures you use, right, that are shiny and glimmer in the water. But it's that Peter is not going to go cast a net. He's going to go cast a single fishing line. And when that fish starts tugging on the line, the very first one, he hooks, he snags, he pulls in. And that will be the exact fish that God and Christ in his sovereignty has lured into your line without lure, will take a bite, you will hook it, you will open its mouth, and there will be a shekel. Now, what's the significance of a shekel? Well, the shekel is a Jewish coin that is equal to 4 drachma. It's the sole ransom payment for the one who doesn't need it in obligation to the law and the one who does need it because of his violation of the law. So we're not told about Peter doing it. We assume it's strange that some commentators say, well, this Jesus was saying this like as a joke. I'm like, what? Because it doesn't say then Peter went out and did just this and paid the tax. No, the assumption of the passage is he said, go do this, and Peter went and did it and paid the tax. When you open its mouth, you will find a shekel, the equivalent of 4 drachma, enough. He says, take that and give it to them for the one who doesn't need it in obligation to the law, and for the one who does need it for the obligation of his ransomed soul to the law. Let us focus in just a minute. Why does Jesus do this? Well, Jesus pays the tax for Peter because Peter needs it paid. But I don't even think that's the emphasis of the passage. The emphasis here is, as you'll see in the top italics, so as not to give offense. Here's the Son of God who has no obligation to pay the ransom soul of the ransom tax of the soul to the temple. But so they would not be offended, he identifies himself as a fellow sinner like everyone else. Jesus is very concerned about offending them. Now, let me just back up and zoom out for a couple of minutes and say, in answer to the question, does Jesus care about offending people? And you know what my question is going to be, or my answer is going to be, right? Yes and no. He's obviously very concerned about offending these guys. He wants to do everything, including doing a miracle in order that these men will not be offended. There are other times that Jesus intentionally offends people. Do you remember that back in chapter 15? Back in Matthew chapter 15, verse 12, when his disciples and he are not washing their hands, verse 12, then the disciples came and said to him, do you know that the Pharisees, and it's the same word, the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying? And Jesus doesn't jump up and go, oh, I'm so sorry, you so misunderstood me. I'm so sorry. He doesn't run over to the Pharisees and say, where's the water, friends? No, he said, let me tell you what's really going on. Then he lays into them, right? There's some people he intentionally offends when it comes to the compromise of the word of God and the gospel. He will offend them and he does not care if they are offended. In this case, he's very sensitive for the sake of the gospel that they not be offended. Same word. He doesn't care in one sense if a certain group stumble in their legalism and their traditions. He's like, yeah, you say not to do that. I'm going to do the opposite of that so that you will be offended, so that you will know that is not a gospel matter. For these poor guys who are coming and sincerely trying to do their job and ask a fair question, though he has no obligation whatsoever and may even take on the risk of misinforming them that he himself is a fellow sinner, he is not willing that they be offended. He says, go get the coin and go pay them. So he's very concerned about offending them. Now, here's why I think Matthew has interest in this. One is Matthew, I think, sees the issue of the atonement that's coming up. This is also an explanation, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, explanation of why it is that Jesus has to go to Jerusalem to be betrayed or handed over and then raised the third day. He's kind of hinting in on this very thing that's going to happen. But notice then in chapter 18, he deals with the issue of an offense again. When they come, chapter 18, who is the greatest? They're having this argument. He says, like, this is how you get into the kingdom, become great in the kingdom, is through humbling yourself. But notice this, verse 5, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me and to sin, ESV is a bad translation, is to be offended. Same word as Matthew 15, 18. Same word is 17 here in verse 27 is the same word here. And what we see from that, he says, You offend one of these little ones, you cause them to stumble. Let me tell you what you would rather have done to you. Now, I can't think many conditions under which I would weigh out what he says and say, oh, I'd rather that happen than this. He said, it would be better for you to have a millstone, a grinding stone weighing hundreds of pounds strapped around your neck, taken out, rowed out into the middle of the lake and say, see you later, dump you over and sink to the bottom. That would be better than making one of these little ones who believe in me to be offended by you. So does Jesus care about people being offended? Yeah, he does. And sometimes the answer is no, he doesn't at all. He wants them to be offended. Man. And Jesus never made a mistake of which one to do. Here's what, let me read you a couple of quotes from R.T. France. How do we distinguish what's going on here? What makes the difference between not caring if you offend to being very careful to offend to saying if you offend something really bad, worse, you would rather have done to you? Here's what France says. Where it is Jesus' own personal privilege that is at stake, that is of being exempt from paying the taxes, he has no problem with accommodating himself to what is expected of him. And in this way, identifying himself with the traditions of his people, the Jesus of Matthew's gospel is not one to stand on his personal dignity, nor to dig his heels in on matters of secondary importance. No problem. If it's a matter of secondary importance, I yield. I'll do what you say. I'll not do what you say. Because I would rather that happen than for you to be offended. But on matters of primary importance, Jesus is like, I'm not budging. You can kill me, and I'm not budging. And it's the wisdom to know the difference. Again, France says, Jesus is always considerate of ordinary and sincere souls. These guys were just trying to do their job and asking a question. He says, I don't want to do anything to offend them. I'll even submit myself to the taxation of the law for the ransom of the soul. So here are some lines of application. What do you do with this? What is the application? How do we participate in this? When it comes to application, and particularly why did Matthew include this into his story, what is it Matthew wanted us to see? Was this a directive on whether we should pay taxes or not? I don't think it has anything to do with that. I don't. I don't think that that's the issue at hand. I don't think that's what he's primarily doing. The issue primarily at hand is, in what cases ought we not to give offense for the sake of the gospel? That's why I chose that 1 Corinthians 9 passage for the opening passage that our brother came up and read for us. Paul says, I become all things to all men, so that I by all means might win some. Well, where did Paul get that disposition? By looking at Jesus, who's like, I don't want these guys to stumble. They don't yet understand the full deal. They're not my followers. They're not my disciples. So yes, I'm going to do anything possible so as they are not offended. So I think that's the centerpiece of why Matthew puts this at this point in his story. The centerpiece seems to be this issue with not causing the tax collectors to stumble. But here's what also gets brought in conjunction with that is in the very process, there's a full breadth of Christology of who Jesus is that's revealed in the process. And Jesus just can't talk or do anything without revealing himself. So I want us to notice a few things from this passage because I really want this to be an event, an opportunity for us to admire and adore and worship Jesus. Show us Christ, right? Is what we prayed in that hymn, in that song. So here's some things I think that are glorious about Jesus that we see in this. First of all, what this reveals to us about Jesus is his penetrating knowledge. I do believe it was miraculous that when Peter walks up, even before he says anything, and Matthew says it the way that he does, that Peter says, let me ask you a question. It's his penetrating knowledge. And are you aware that there's nothing in your life and there's no questions that you are asking or being asked that Jesus isn't penetratively aware? You know what I mean? I just like to make up words. That Jesus doesn't penetrate in his knowledge of you and what you're struggling with and all that is in your life and the questions that people are asking you and the uncertainty and the struggles that you have, that Jesus is revealed here as the one who has penetrating knowledge into our lives. Which, by the way, if he's on your side, that's a really good comforting thing, isn't it? If Jesus isn't on your side, I mean, there's nothing like the omniscience of God, that God knows anything, that is either more comforting or more terrifying. Because like, if you know God is for you, the fact that he knows everything about you is incredibly encouraging. Because he keeps my tears in a bottle and he doesn't forget any of my wailings and he knows me and he understands me. But if God is your enemy, there's nothing more terrifying that he knows everything about you, including your deepest thoughts. That's terrifying. And that he will hold you accountable for every word and deed and thought that you've ever had in the entirety of your life. So here, even Jesus' penetrating knowledge, even of these men, show us his glory. The second thing I think we see in this passage is his conscientiousness of his unique sonship. He understands who he is uniquely. Now this raises a question about why does he say sons, plural? Is he including the apostles at this point? I'm going to say yes and no. And I'm going to get to the yes in just a minute. But the no of it is, he's using the analogy to talk about himself as being exempt from paying the tax. More on that in just a second. But his conscientiousness of his unique sonship, like he's exempt, he's perfect, he's the Son of God. Third, his sovereignty over creation. I mean, talking about penetrating knowledge, I know which fish will be at what place in the exact second that you throw out that hook that you're going to hook and pull in, that swallow that coin last week on Tuesday at 1 a.m. I know exactly which fish and where he's going to be when you throw him. That's amazing. Or perhaps there's something else. I know where that fish is. I know that there's a fish I'm going to direct him to. I don't know. How does that work? Well, your guess is as good as mine. But nevertheless, he threw out the hook, hooked this fish, brought him in. It shows us here Jesus' amazing sovereignty over creation. There are no accidents. There are no, in the ultimate sense, happenstances or accidents. And then we see here his considerateness toward others, which I think is the key to the passage. It's really the heart of the passage. He cares that they not stumble and will do things above and beyond the ordinary, even to the point of miraculous, so that they would not stumble. And so as worshipers of Christ, would you go away today and spend some time meditating and thinking about who this is, who is the centerpiece of our faith? Here's the thing. Well, one of the guys I listened to, and you can, if you don't like this or you think I shouldn't do it or something, we can talk about it afterwards. But one of the men I'm listening to right now who's not a Christian that has been incredibly insightful to me in a number of ways is a fellow by the name of Jordan Peterson. Anybody know Jordan Peterson? Heard the name? A few of you? All right. Jordan Peterson. There's some things he says that are so illuminating and so deep and so layered and so thought-provoking that I am compelled by him in many ways. But here's something that when it comes down to the person of Jesus, he is off the charts wrong, or it doesn't get yet, or is not yet understood. And that is that Jesus isn't just some kind of localized example of transcendence or of greatness or of moral value or some things. It's like, in the words of C.S. Lewis, all of the myths and all of the truisms and all of the transcendence actually became a man. God became flesh, and Jesus was an actual historical figure who came into this world. So these aren't just examples of what penetrating knowledge is like. These aren't just examples of what consideration of it. This is God in the flesh, fully embodying them. And there JP is just totally off his rocker, or yet not even sat on the rocker yet. And again, I say that with, as a man with great admiration and appreciation of him. If you don't know who he is, then we can talk later. But as worshipers of Christ, we're just saying that Jesus isn't a way to the truth. He is the truth. He isn't just a way of life. He is life. That he's not just an example of a son of God. He is uniquely the Son of God. So as worshipers of Christ, we surely can go away and say above Odin and above Beelzebul and above all of the pagan gods and goddesses and the things that enthrall us with this world, that Jesus is the exquisite example of God become flesh and dwelling among us and became one of us and sympathizes with us. And if that doesn't just cause our heart to pitter-patter, man, what else will? The new season of whatever? Well, if that causes your heart to pitter-patter and Jesus doesn't, oh my goodness, where are we? And so as worshipers of Christ, let's absorb from this story these things that we see of him. And then as imitators of Christ, and there's things here we can imitate, but the imitation that I want us to particularly focus on is here, his consideration toward others. And here you'll see the passages, 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 23, 9 through 12. Of having wisdom in our day, because you can get in a fight. I mean, just say anything publicly on social media or elsewhere. Just say something publicly anywhere and you're in a fight. I mean, like it or not. It's a very tumultuous time, a very pugnacious culture that we live in. But we should pick our battles carefully. All things that the Bible teaches are of value and true, but not everything is of equal importance. And Jesus shows us that here in this passage. So let us pick our battles carefully. Here's what Paul says, 1 Corinthians 9, 19. For though I am free from all, I have made my servant to all, that I may win more of them. To the Jews, I became a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law. That's what Jesus is doing here. He says, verse 23, I do it all for the sake of the gospel, not being cool, not being hip, not being trendy, not being fitting in with the crowd, but the things that he does in conformity so that others will not stumble is for the sake of the gospel that I may share with them in the blessings. And here's what J.C. Ryle says. Let me read a couple quotes from Ryle and then we'll stop. These words teach that in relation to the world, now Ryle, that there are matters in which Christ's people ought to sink their own opinions and submit to requirements which they may not thoroughly approve, rather than give offense and hinder the gospel of Christ. It may sound very fine and seem very heroic to be always standing out tenaciously for our rights, but it may well be doubted with such a passage as this whether such tenacity is always wise and shows the mind of Christ. And then Ryle applies this to the church. That's to the world. To the church, he says this, who can tell the damage that has been done to the cause of the gospel by morbid scrupulosity and conscientiousness? Or I'd say even determination for preferences. And so what we see is needed in this is love and wisdom as to when to give offense, like Jesus does, and when not to give offense, as when Jesus does. While there are times when a disciple must take an unpopular stand and so alienate others, many of the issues and practices on which we might legitimately differ from conventional assumptions are not all worth fighting over. Again, R.T. France. He says, a Christian community which sets up stumbling blocks only when it is really necessary is likely to be more effective on mission. But let me close with this. Some of you have already picked up on it, is the foreshadowing of the gospel. What's happening here in this two-coin payment? He sends Peter out to go get this shekel for the sake of the four drachmas to pay for Peter. What we have here is Jesus pays the soul ransom for others through miraculous act. Jesus can't even pay taxes without preaching the gospel. Go pay it for me, who am not under obligation of the law because of my sinlessness to pay it. And in doing so, I will make provision for you as well. And folks, that's the gospel. Jesus came, lived under the law, and died under the penalty of the law, not because he deserved it. He went to the cross, not because he was a criminal worth paying under the penalty of the law of death. He went there so as we would not be offended by sin and lose our souls. But in doing so, he pays a ransom for others. He pays a ransom, if you will believe, he pays that ransom for you in his miraculous act. And you think that catching a fish with a coin in its mouth is miraculous. the cross and the resurrection is even more miraculous. And the gospel preaching here is that even in paying his tax, in doing this, he brings them into his sonship. And now what happens? We're no longer under the law. We're no longer under the soul penalty. We no longer pay a ransom. We no longer have to go to the temple and offer sacrifices because of what Jesus did on the cross, his coin in fish mouth event. Because of what he does there, he brings us into sonship, so we are exempt from paying the soul ransom because our Savior has paid for us. It's amazing to me that even in an account like this, I apologize for going so long over in time, but I don't want to leave this out, that it is the gospel that even in Jesus not offending and even in Jesus catching fish through Peter, that the gospel is preached for the ransom of our souls. Thank you for your patience. Let's please pray and go to the Lord's Supper. Lord Jesus, thank you for caring for us. Thank you for having the wisdom to know when to offend and when not to offend. Thank you for paying the soul ransom tribute in the temple of our God on our behalf. Lord, may we be more like you. May we admire what we've seen from you in this passage. We want to see more of you. We want to understand and worship and adore more of you. So thank you for this time in your word. Thank you that your word is deep and broad and so majestic as we come to it to try to understand it. And there are layers like layers of an onion as we try to understand your word and your gospel. So thank you for this time together. Lord, bless it as we go in our ways. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.